Hi, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point. Russia's brutal war on Ukraine turns out to be as much about refugees as it is about combat. U.S. media have played down the racial discrimination that crosses the borders of Europe, but it's an important part of the story, too. We'll hear more about that in a few moments. First, the possible outcomes of the most destructive event since World War II in that part of the world. A conflict that could get worse before it gets better. To get an assessment, a team from Foreign Policy magazine has spoken to more than a dozen U.S. and European officials, to military analysts and regional experts as well, and they've come up with five broad scenarios of what might be in store. Amy McKinnon is a defense and security correspondent who's part of the team. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Very quickly, you've got a bloody stalemate, you've got the partition of Ukraine, a decisive victory of one side or the other, a peace agreement, and what you refer to as a black swan event, and we'll find out what that means when we get there. First of all, let's talk about a bloody stalemate. What are the chances of that? What does it mean?
I think the chances of a bloody stalemate, based on our conversations with the people we spoke to for this piece, are quite high. That Russia has not been able to achieve its objectives. You know, they thought they could go in and take Kiev incredibly quickly within a few days. That is clearly not the case. In fact, we're learning now that Russian defense officials are at least saying they're going to pull back from Kiev. TBD if they're actually going to follow through with that, I think. And so the war is kind of shifting, and Ukrainian forces have fought, very hard and very smart, and they've managed to attrition several thousand Russian forces. And so I think there is quite a high likelihood that, you know, a stalemate may settle in. And the reason we called it a bloody stalemate is I think that both sides are going to try and pick off as many of the other's troops as they can to try and gain more ground. And I think as one of the quotes we have in the piece says from Jim Townsend, who is a former senior Pentagon official, you know, he said he fears this may be like the Balkan Wars in the 90s, where both sides are just going to look to exhaust themselves on the battlefield, basically, before they feel that they are in a position where they can negotiate.
Would it likely involve more total destruction of cities like what's happened in Mariupol?
It's very hard to say. I mean, the first thing a lot of folks said to us was, you know, war is inherently unpredictable. We've definitely seen that already in the 1 month that this war has gone on for. There's been a lot of twists and turns that many really didn't predict. I think what we are likely to see is the focus of the conflict shifting towards the east as the Russians try and, I think, consolidate some territorial gains they have there. And I certainly, I'm not going to rule out anything from the Russian playbook. I mean, they've proven very willing to be incredibly brutal thus far. And unless there is some kind of breakthrough at the negotiating table, I do fear that may continue. I mean, many people told us that they fear that this will get worse before it gets better.
So that brings us to option number two, which would be the partition of Ukraine. What would that look like?
So one scenario that a few folks sketched out for us was, you know, if Russia is able to take Mariupol on the south coast, and many fear that that could happen within days, that will give them a very strategic kind of jumping off point to push north. And then they have another advance coming down from the north around Kharkiv. And that if those two advances are able to join up with each other, that would, firstly, it would surround an incredible number of Ukrainian troops that are operating in the area in the joint force operations area, and cut them off from the rest of the Ukrainian military. I think estimates vary, but one European official said that there's estimated to be around 40% of Ukraine's armed forces in that area. So you can imagine what that would mean for the Ukrainians if they lost access to those troops. But then it would also give Russia a much bigger chunk of Ukrainian territory to use as leverage in negotiations.
It is said that the partition would include Crimea. And of course, President Zelensky of Ukraine has said he's not in for that.
Well, even this is shifting. I mean, we're speaking on Tuesday, and one of the Ukrainian negotiators from the talks in Turkey today said that they would be willing to discuss some kind of 15-year agreement to promise to that Russia and Ukraine would resolve the Crimean issue within 15 years. So, in short, essentially kicking the can down the road on the question of Crimea. And so that, to me, says that I think what we're seeing this week is that both sides have been able to inflict an incredible amount of pain on the other. Of course, the brunt of that pain is being felt by Ukrainians and Ukrainian civilians. But I think the Russians are, of course, surprised at the losses that they're taking. And that has, you know, things that were, you know, unspeakable and absolutely unnegotiable several weeks ago may now start to come onto that negotiating table.
To tell our listeners, we're speaking at the very, very end of the month of March. So let's move on to option number three, a decisive victory for one side or the other. What would a decisive victory for Ukraine look like?
Well, we kind of threw this one in the piece, even though I think most people don't seem to think it's incredibly likely at this stage. But it's obviously something that, you know, you want to kind of discuss and look at in the context of exploring where a war may go. I think a decisive victory for Ukraine would be, you know, Russian forces entirely out of the country, basically undoing what they have done since the invasion began on February 24th. I think that looks very unlikely. And I think, you know, the Russian aim of seizing Kiev, of seizing, you know, most, if not all of Ukraine also seems incredibly unlikely. And so that leads us on to, I think, the next scenario on the list, which is a peace negotiation, which is ultimately probably the only way that this conflict will end. But when that is, what kind of losses there will be, what kind of pain will be inflicted on Ukraine between now and then is still very much up in the air.
Before we move on from decisive victory, that presumably would include the elimination of the current government, and very particularly President Zelensky, one way or another.
Yeah, that did seem to be one of their aims going in. And Zelensky's team has said that there's been several plots against him, several attempts on his life, none of which have seemed to have been successful. So for now, it seems the Russians may be moving on from that aim. But I'm not going to be convinced until we see kind of true and meaningful movement from Russian troops on the ground.
There have been reports that a Russian commander, at least one Russian commander, was in fact killed by his own troops who were unhappy about the way that things were going. What about the morale of the Russian troops, and how important is that to one option or another?
Morale is incredibly important in a conflict like this, and it's not a question for the Ukrainians. They know why they're fighting this war. This is an existential war for them. For the Russians, it's been more problematic. I mean, for one thing, it appears that Russian troops were not prepared to go into war. And many of these are incredibly young, you know, some of them in their late teens, early 20s, you know, barely out of high school, barely out of college, or kind of college age kids who were stationed along the border, who were told that they were there for exercises. And then, you know, with 24 hours notice, we're told, oh, actually, you're going into the biggest land war in Europe since World War II. And so, you know, we know that they've had problems with securing their communications and that they've been speaking on unsecured networks, which has enabled not only the Ukrainian intelligence and military to eavesdrop on those calls, but also just ham radio enthusiasts and journalists as well. And the New York Times has done some very good reporting on those intercepted calls. And what comes across is a great amount of shock from the Russian troops on the ground, you know, saying, you know, essentially calling home to their parents and saying, we didn't know this was going on. We're being asked to do all these terrible things. And as you know, as one person said to me last week, Jack Watlin, who's an expert on land warfare with RUSI, a think tank in London, he said, you know, we didn't expect that Russia would be so callous and so cruel to its own troops. And so I imagine there is quite a lot of pent up frustration going on amongst the ranks. And that will undoubtedly have effect on how fierce they're able to fight.
I heard a report early on about conscripts who were painting buildings or something and picked up and sent off to Ukraine. What on the other side about the mercenaries? Is it the Wagner? Is that the name of the organization that people are worried about?
Yes. The Wagner Group is a... it's a complicated one to classify because it, you know, it's often described as a private military contractor. It's not really private. It's very closely enmeshed with the Russian arm, with the Russian defense and intelligence structures. And the U.S. government has essentially called it a proxy for the Russian military. And it's been used around the world, first used in the conflict in Ukraine in 2014, and they've been deployed in Libya, in Syria, and now in a number of countries in Africa. And it's typically used as, these mercenaries are typically used as kind of expeditionary forces on behalf of the Kremlin's geopolitical goals. And, you know, they're often sent in small formations, maybe just, you know, a couple thousand. There's no oversight on them. So they have been incredibly fierce and brutal. And in one instance in Syria, certainly accused of gross war crimes, essentially. That's a legal case which is still pending. But they've been sent in to kind of, you know, tip the balance in the favor of Russia. But there's been reports that these Wagner forces now may be sent into Ukraine. But I struggle to see how, you know, even if they're able to scrape together a few thousand mercenaries, you know, how that is going to change the calculus on the battlefield in any significant way when you have, you know, almost 200,000 regular Russian forces sent in. It's also not clear how easily they will integrate with regular Russian forces. They have, you know, I assume they haven't trained together, they haven't exercised together. Whether they're going to have that level of coordination to fight effectively is also unclear.
So we've talked about bloody stalemate, partition of Ukraine, decisive victory by one side or the other. And now we get to the fourth option, the peace agreement. And you think that's the most likely?
I think so. I mean, given that an outright victory, as we said earlier, seems to be extremely unlikely, I think, save for a black swan event, and I know we'll get to that in a minute.
We will, yeah.
I think a peace settlement is the only way that this is going to go. We're starting to see, I think, both sides taking this. Well, I think the Ukrainians have always taken this incredibly seriously, but we're starting to see, I think, an evolution in the positions of both sides and what they're willing to talk about and what may be on the table for a peace agreement. But I still think there is a very long way to go. The other thing I would say is, you know, there's been talk of a potential ceasefire deal, which, of course, you know, would be hugely welcomed. Any break in the fighting would be hugely welcomed. But, you know, military analysts have been, you know, bringing this up with me for a few weeks now, that, you know, we may see a ceasefire, but the Russians may actually only use that as a chance to unscramble these logistical challenges that they've been having, to resupply their troops, to restock, and then to go on and fight a second round of the war and fight, you know, better prepared and even harder than the first time. So a ceasefire, you know, would be a real breakthrough, but it does not by any means necessarily signal an end to the fighting.
All right, let's get to black swan event. What do you mean by that?
So black swan event is the kind of thing that officials mean to describe something which is highly unexpected, probably unlikely, but that if it did happen, could drastically alter events. I mean, think of the pandemic that we've all been living through the past couple of years. I mean, that... not many of us saw that coming, and it, you know, radically altered everybody's lives and the world. And that's the kind of thing that people mean when they say a black swan event. And so we know from reporting in the Washington Post and the New York Times that that the Biden administration, the National Security Council, has stood up a tiger team, which is a term which is used for kind of an emergency team of senior U.S. officials across several agencies that come together to look at potential, you know, to look at emergency situations and U.S. responses. And of course, one of the things that they will be looking at and kind of gaming out are these black swan events. And I should say, I don't know what black swan events they're looking at, but I would imagine the kind of things that they will be thinking about are, what happens if Russia uses a chemical weapon? You know, what does that mean for NATO, for the U.S.? How do we respond? You know, what if fighting builds in Western Ukraine and spills over into Poland, which is a member of NATO and protected under the Article 5 Mutual Defense Agreement? You know, what happens then? What happens if, God forbid, Russia uses a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine? So these are the kind of things we mean by a black swan event. And also, actually, one of the ones we looked at in our piece is, well, what if there's some kind of palace coup in Moscow and Putin is dethroned, and what that would mean as well. All of these, I think, are relatively unlikely, save for perhaps the use of chemical weapons. That is something that the Biden administration have said they fear that Russia is kind of trying to prepare the groundwork for. But, you know, I think the goal of officials in these kind of very uncertain times is to try and think the unthinkable and then work back from there so that they are at least prepared in the event that the unthinkable does happen.
In terms of Putin and the Russian elite, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church today, pardon me, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church has very recently given his okay and been very supportive of the invasion, where it had been hoped that he would see it the other way and didn't happen. How important is the church, and is that a religious motivation to Putin himself and to Russians in general, and especially the troops?
I think that will be a very powerful endorsement, and particularly in the eyes of the public. I think it will be very significant for the Kremlin efforts to sell this to the Russian public. Under the past several years, the Russian Orthodox Church has undergone a real revival under Putin. He has, closely enmeshed the state with the Russian Orthodox Church and often kind of leans on them to give blessing to his actions, and in this instance, his war. And so I think it will be seen as quite a powerful endorsement. There's been a huge drive in Russia across the past 10 years to build, last time I was there was 2016, but you see new churches springing up all across the country. And the church has been used as a kind of conduit for Kremlin messaging and for Putin's messaging as well.
That's really interesting, because of course communism was an atheistic approach.
Absolutely.
And led to the creation of the Soviet Union, of course, which is now no longer in existence. What Putin says is the worst thing that's happened in I forget how many centuries. Quickly, I can't help but ask you, how did Black Swan events get to be called Black Swan?
That's a very good question. I actually have no idea. I mean, I assume black swans are rare in nature.
Maybe so.
They tend to be white, but I don't know.
Oh, wait a minute. Our producer, Andrea Brody, has come up with this. The term black swan was coined by Lebanese-American essayist and mathematical statistician Nassim Nicholas Taleb. In 2001, he wrote a book with the title Black Swan to explain, among other things, the disproportionate role of high-profile, hard-to-predict, and rare events that are beyond the realm of normal expectations. So you had a pretty good way of defining it yourself. And it's important to realize, particularly when we talk about black swan events, that even though people may be hearing this after the fact, all of these things are possible at virtually any time.
Potentially, but I think the risk is low. I mean, people we have spoken to, see the risk of use of nuclear weapons is still really quite low. But the reason that it's being discussed and it's being considered is because, Putin has tried to rattle the saber on this. He put his nuclear forces, he actually adjusted their alert status, but as far as I understand, no U.S. officials are kind of puzzled by what status their alert is on, because it does not match with their usual kind of ladder of how we understand that they work with their nuclear forces, which is a bit of a tangent, but I took that to mean that I think I see it as more saber rattling than a serious effort to really put his nuclear forces on alert. But, as I said earlier, I think this is all about thinking the unthinkable and trying to be prepared for should the worst happen. But to reassure people, my understanding is that this is really quite a low risk at this stage.
Okay.
I would just add, I think another reason I think this is unlikely is I think the Kremlin truly doesn't know how NATO and how the US will respond. And I think any use of nuclear weapons, they would see that as a very quick way to get embroiled, to potentially provoke the US and NATO and its NATO allies to rethink their current posture on the conflict and to potentially get involved. And given how badly they've performed in Ukraine, I think any sane Russian official would seriously question how equipped they are to deal with a conflict with US or NATO forces. That's another reason why I think it's quite unlikely at this stage.
Amy McKinnon, it's been great to have you with us, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, President Biden has promised that the U.S. will fight to defend NATO countries, but he insists we won't fight in Ukraine, which could lead to a confrontation with Russia and World War III. But one U.S. official says he's setting unnecessary limits and deferring to Vladimir Putin. That's a harsh assessment, but Dr. Evelyn Farkas has the authority to make it. She's been Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, and Senior Advisor to the Supreme Commander in Europe. In 2009, she was Executive Director of the Bipartisan Commission on Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction. Dr. Farkas, it is a privilege to talk with you, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Warren. The privilege is mine.
How are we deferring to Vladimir Putin? Are we still doing it?
Well, to some extent, I think we still are, because we still have hesitated to provide things like fighter aircraft. I gather we are going to provide S-300s to the Ukrainians, but I saw some language, you know, that it didn't seem as forthright as it might have been.
What are S-300s?
S-300s are Russian-based systems, so Soviet-era systems. The technology is Soviet-era. And they're air defense systems, and they can help the Ukrainians shoot down aircraft attacking them at higher altitudes, or potentially also incoming missiles at higher altitudes. So it's a very important system, and I guess I sensed a little bit of hesitation about talking about them publicly, and this again goes back to the broader point that I was trying to make in my piece in the Washington Post, which is to say that we should not be publicly discussing what we don't want to send Ukraine to defend itself because we think it might cause Russia to escalate its, you know, in its response. We should just decide what we are willing to provide to Ukraine, what we have in our inventory, what we can provide without risk to the defense of our allies in the eastern part of NATO, and provide that to Ukraine. And obviously what they know how to use, which is why these old Soviet era systems are coming into play. But the more we telegraph publicly what we don't want to provide, or what we're frankly afraid to provide because of the potential reaction out of Moscow, the more we play into Moscow's hands and we tie our own hands. And we don't know how the conflict will unfold, and we don't know what equipment and what other actions we might want to take in the future. So it's best not to talk about what we will not do.
You mentioned fighter aircraft a moment ago, and in your piece in the Washington Post, you talk about dithering about providing fighter jets. Could we do that without a direct confrontation that the president talks about and warns that if that happens, it's going to be World War III?
Providing fighter aircraft, I see no distinction between that and providing javelins and the Stingers. So the javelins are missiles that we use to, that they use rather, well, we use them too, but they are missiles intended to take out tanks. The Stingers are missiles intended to take out lower flying aircraft. The fighter aircraft can take out other aircraft. The Ukrainians would be flying them, we wouldn't be flying them. So in that respect, it's no different than providing them with the other equipment.
Would they be shooting down Russian aircraft, and would that then come closer to our being involved in direct confrontation with Russia?
No, because we've already provided them with the Stinger aircraft, which have shot down multiple aircraft. I don't want to use the Ukrainian numbers because we haven't verified them, but the Ukrainians have a pretty aggressive list of helicopters they've shot out of the air using these missiles.
What about the idea of World War III, which we hear again from the President of the United States? President Zelensky has said we're already in it.
Well, I would argue that we're not in World War III, but World War III is also not an automatic escalation, as some people make it sound. You know, if we were to have an inadvertent or intentional exchange of gunfire with Russians, any NATO ally, it doesn't mean we're automatically escalating to World War III or to a nuclear standoff. Certainly, if the Russians attack a NATO ally or NATO territory, that would lead to, I guess, World War III. But if we're talking about something happening in the context, for example, of protecting civilians during a situation where Russia has agreed to a humanitarian corridor, for example, I don't think if aircraft were shot down, it would lead automatically to World War III. And that's why some of us have proposed keeping the idea of a humanitarian no-fly corridor on the table for the moment.
Well, what if Vladimir Putin assumed that that was the first shot in World War III? You indicated in your piece that to some extent we're assuming that he is a rational actor.
Yes, I mean, we are assuming right now that he doesn't want NATO to enter the war, and I think that's correct right now. Of course, it could always change, and then that is dangerous for us because we don't want to expand this war. NATO does not want to get involved directly, and certainly any NATO involvement would actually potentially help Vladimir Putin globally for those fence-sitting countries like India, and also help him domestically convincing the Russian people that their war is not with the Ukrainian people, but it's actually with the West, with NATO. So we need to do everything we can to avoid getting involved in this war directly, absolutely. But we also need to make sure that we are creatively thinking about how best to help the Ukrainians defend themselves and how to keep as many Ukrainians alive as possible. And so this is where, you know, many of us, and I've called for in this piece, maximum flexibility and not telegraphing to Putin what we will not do. Rather, it's better to keep him guessing about what we might be willing to do, what kind of risks we might be willing to accept.
What about the concern that has been raised, particularly with the fence-sitting countries that you mentioned, if, in fact, we are restrained because we're worried about going to nuclear weapons, about Putin going to nuclear weapons, everybody's going to want to have nuclear weapons, even those that don't have them now.
Right. I mean, I think that's a very valid concern, that if we really do not, if we limit our assistance to Ukraine, and especially if that results in Ukraine losing this war, then you better believe that every country that is worried about whether America and its allies will defend them, or worried about a larger country coming in and taking over, will seek nuclear weapons. So we will have a nuclear proliferation problem like we've never had before. Certainly the Japanese and the South Koreans will start to question, although, of course, Ukraine is not a NATO member, so it does make it distinct from the alliances like the ones we have with Japan, South Korea, and the NATO allies. But nevertheless, I think that it will cause proliferators to increase their interest in acquiring nuclear weapons if they see that just having these weapons and having an aggressive military doctrine that calls for their use, if they see that that is sufficient to cause the United States to stay its hand, to not use the full assistance that it can provide or the full power that it has to assist a country in need that has clearly, you know, been attacked without just cause or provocation, they will look for a guarantee like that.
NATO has some countries that have nuclear weapons and some that don't. Do you think NATO will hold together? It appeared before the invasion that it might not. At the moment, it does seem to be doing so. How long is that going to last?
I am not concerned at all about the unity of NATO. I think that this challenge, this horrendous war that Russia has unleashed, you know, upon the Ukrainian people has resulted in an unprecedented unity and revulsion, frankly, on the part of all of the transatlantic allies. And I see no reason why in the foreseeable future our unity would waver.
What about this issue of Putin as a rational actor? And to what degree is he driven, do you think, given what he has said about the fact that Ukraine doesn't exist and that individuals don't matter? Is there a philosophical basis to the kinds of things that he's saying? I know there's a philosopher named Ilyin who talks that way, and Putin seems to be devoted to him.
Yeah, he likes this idea of Novorossiya, you know, a new Russia, kind of a new Russian empire, the notion that somehow all of these peoples, Russians, Ukrainians, they're one, and that he can secure his place in history by recreating this kind of new Russia. But it's also very much fed by his anger and his, you know, personal, I guess, humiliation at the way the Soviet Union fell apart and the impact that it had on him and the security services initially, at least. So he is sane, but he is misguided, and he has a misunderstanding of the past and certainly of the present and the future.
What about the personal humiliation of having so many of his soldiers killed, of having Ukrainian soldiers be able to take over his tanks and trucks and use them against Russian soldiers? The fact that, for the moment at least, he seems to have made some very, very serious mistakes.
Well, first, Warren, let's hope that all of that news is getting back to him, because we don't know what kind of communications are ongoing, you know, basically between the armed forces, the leadership of the armed forces, and the Kremlin, to include Vladimir Putin. We don't know whether the military commanders in the field are communicating clearly to superiors in Moscow. We do not know. Clearly, we know the Russian people don't know what's happening. But I even question how much Vladimir Putin understands. And if he does understand, you know, obviously it's an added humiliation. He will try, as every autocrat would, to paint it in the most possible, you know, the best possible light. Unfortunately, I think that also means that he's going to continue with his current course of action, because at present, if he were to halt it, he would not be able to have enough to show for the humiliation of losing all of these lives. And really, it's more than a humiliation. It's a disaster. It's a tragedy for the Russian people.
Well, that's fascinating that the generals might not be giving him full information. I know several generals have been killed, which is unusual in a situation like this. And evidently, Russia has a sort of top-down as opposed to bottom-up way of dealing with its military. But Putin had that big rally recently, and it was widely regarded as one that was brought about by the fact that he had been seeing the kind of things that we are all seeing on television, and consequently that he at least knew that much.
Yeah, and Warren, I should be clear, I don't have any information that he's not getting information from the military commanders. I just wonder, and since it was kind of an assumption built into your question, I wanted to kind of lay it out there.
Okay.
But he must clearly understand that he has to be communicating something to the Russian people, because they are feeling the impact of the sanctions. And so he has to explain to them, why is this happening suddenly? And to rally them, because he knows that it's going to get worse for them economically. So I'm not entirely sure whether the rally was oriented towards making them feel better about the war per se, or the losses on the battlefield, because the public certainly appears to have been left in the dark about that. We'll see how long that can last, because of course at some point people will start to wonder where their loved ones went to. But at the same time, he cannot deny the impact on the average Russian that they're feeling every day. So I think his first objective was to make them understand that they had to tighten their belt for the cause of the motherland.
How divided do you think Russia itself is? There were a lot of people at that rally. There were rumors that a lot of them were paid to go there. But there are also these stories about how they hear from their relatives in Ukraine and don't believe that, in fact, there is the kind of destruction going on that we see every day on TV.
Yeah, this is also another element of this tragedy, where the Russian disinformation has been so thorough that many Russians, and indeed most Russians, rely on the state television, and they believe what they are being told every evening, and they've believed it for years. And so the only chance for breakthrough is, you know, maybe these relatives calling, but then they turn around and they don't believe them. So unfortunately, I think it's going to take some people coming back from the field, or maybe not coming back, but some Russians will survive this and reporting back to in their towns and villages where they are, of course, will be credible. And that takes time. So this is the problem. Right now, we want to convince the Russian people, the Russian government, as fast as possible that they need to stop this war. And we need to do that by getting information into Russia, by putting the pressure on them economically, and at the same time, giving the Ukrainians everything they need to quickly, you know, do something to prevail on the battlefield. And this is why the air component is so troubling, because that's the part that's missing here. And if we want to do, we want a quick end to this war, all this pressure has to be fast.
We've been talking about a lot of questions that have been raised in the media for weeks now, and which will no doubt be raised in the media for weeks to come. And they would include things we haven't quite talked about yet, such as the role of China, the role of Israel, possible brokers, and does Putin need an exit ramp, and so on. But let me ask you a personal question. Given your background, which is so detailed and extensive in this area, what's your personal feelings about this at the moment? I don't want to get too touchy-feely in the question, but I just have to ask it.
I'm a political scientist, but, you know, in life, you can have the best minds, but at the end of the day, it's your values, it's the passion that you bring to something that matters most. And so I am driven by the fact that my parents are political refugees. They fled communist Hungary in 1956. I went back and lived in communist Hungary in summers with my grandparents. I know the difference between democracy and autocracy. And I feel that there is a great deal at stake here in Ukraine, including the future of our democracy, because we see elements of our society, politicians in America, and late night television commentators actually taking sides with Moscow, which is astonishing to me, something we couldn't have, you know, ever expected even during the, you know, Cold War. So for me, I feel very strongly that what makes America, you know, special is not just our democracy, but of course we learn from our democracy, and like other democratic states, we have a certain resilience. But I am alarmed at also the great damage that has been done to our democracy by these autocrats. And I think it's very important for us. We have a commitment. We had a commitment to Ukraine coming out of the Budapest Memorandum when they turned over their nuclear weapons, and we should abide by that commitment. And ultimately, it's about the international order. The international order is what allows us to live as Democrats, in small d Democrats, in America today. So for me, it is partly personal.
What about the question that you have dealt with the report on the world at risk having to do with weapons of mass destruction? Are we closer? I don't know if you look at the bulletin of the atomic scientists, but how close to midnight are we? And are you worried that this could escalate into a nuclear war?
Right. I know I need to get my latest issue of Arms Control today. You know it's unfortunately, these are very real issues. They never went away. We've seen Russia break weapons of mass destruction taboos by using polonium to assassinate one of their former agents in London. And then we saw them use Novichok, a chemical weapon, to also assassinate opponents, or attempt to assassinate opponents. And so Russia has already broken the taboo, and we saw in Syria also use of chemical weapons. So we're in a very dangerous phase right now, because I'm afraid that this Kremlin doesn't view these weapons of mass destruction, certainly doesn't view humanitarian or human lives and the Geneva Conventions in the way that the rest of us do. So we are in a much more dangerous phase, unfortunately, because this is where I don't trust Vladimir Putin's perspective on this. And this is not to say that he is not being rational. It's just that he doesn't care about human life, and he could contemplate using a nuclear weapon given his military doctrine and given the fact that the doctrine contemplates using it in order to clear your opponent off the battlefield, in order to scare your opponent off the battlefield. So it's an intimidation tool.
But we have mass assured destruction, and that's the whole idea, that you have nuclear weapons in order to prevent anybody else from using them. So if, in fact, he did use a nuclear weapon, what should we do? Should we necessarily then use another one ourselves?
No, because I believe that nuclear weapons are horrible. We're the only country to have used them before in the Second World War in Japan, and we need to do everything in our power to ensure that they aren't used. We have enough problems coming down the pike just with climate change. We don't need to contribute to doomsday by using nuclear weapons ourselves. And if Russia did use a nuclear weapon, it would be the end of the regime. The world revulsion would be such that I don't think, you know, there would be any limits anymore on what we would do in order to stop Vladimir Putin. I think at that point, all of these discussions about what kind of risk NATO would take or whether NATO would be in a fight with Russia would be moot, because any country that uses nuclear weapons, any government that uses nuclear weapons against another defenseless country or in any scenario, really doesn't deserve to exist under international law and order. It is clearly a threat then at that point to international peace and security on a whole nother level.
But there is a limit, you suggested, that we should not use nuclear weapons in response.
That's correct. We don't need to. We have sufficient conventional forces to essentially decapitate the Russian government if that's what's required. Again, if they were to use nuclear weapons in any scenario.
Is there anything you can say at the moment that could end this interview on a positive note?
I mean, right now my head is spinning because I can't believe we're having this conversation. It's so horrendous. You know, when we wrote that report, The World at Risk, in 2008, then we were worried about proliferation of not weapons, but nuclear material and terrorism. And that threat hasn't completely gone away either. What can I do to make you feel better? I will say that at the end of the day, you asked me a question about feelings, you know, and I answered about spirit and values. At the end of the day, I think that the Ukrainian values and spirit will prevail. I do not think that Vladimir Putin will win. He did not explain to his military or his people what he was doing here. He may be a cold-hearted killer, but the Russian people are not a cold-hearted, killing, brutal people. And once they figure out what's happening, they will not condone it. In addition to that, I really believe that the world will continue to rally behind Ukraine. And so as an optimist and somebody who does believe that ultimately right will prevail, even if it looks like might has, or the wrong side has more power. So I believe Ukraine will survive as a sovereign state.
You sound like President Zelensky. Are you inspired by him?
I'm very much inspired by him. I think, again, as somebody who comes from Eastern Europe, who knows what it's like not to have democracy or to live in a situation where you don't have democracy, I value what you have in a democracy. And I understand the notion of fighting for what you believe in and taking risks for what you believe in. And I honor that. And I truly believe that they can prevail. And you learn as you get older that it really is the emotional and the visceral that ultimately carries an effort across the line.
Well, these are scary times. I was drafted into the Army in 1963. And I was sent to, I don't know if you were aware that Fort Monroe in Virginia was for a time the headquarters of the Continental Army Command.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned there and I was in the information office. And I learned just how close we got to nuclear war in Cuba, which I don't think a lot of people realized by that time. And this is as scared as I've ever been since then.
It is frightening. And I don't know, you know, what to do, because on the one hand, the only way we can win and maintain you know, the international order, frankly, is to push Putin to the wall. But of course, the closer he gets to that wall, the more dangerous he becomes potentially. But there's no way out, you know, so we just have to be hope that the military won't, his military won't follow his orders. I mean, it's really just like Hitler in the bunker.
Well, Dr. Farkas, it's been really instructive to talk with you. And thank you so much for being so candid and being willing to go into the personal, because I think that's the way a lot of people, of course, who aren't experts have to look at this. And to hear it from your point of view is really instructive. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Warren.
In a moment, some refugees are encountering racial discrimination as they try to get out of Ukraine into bordering countries. I'll be right back with To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. For weeks now, Ukrainian refugees have streamed across several borders in the tens of thousands, and many have been welcomed in neighboring countries. In Warsaw, for example, the mayor of the city told CNN, there is no limit to the generosity of the Polish people. But others say that is not true for every desperate immigrant. With us today is Giovanni Petty. He is director of the Global Migration Center at UC Davis. He's also a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to you. Glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
We have been told, and there has been a publication in various places, that there's been just appalling racism experienced by people of color trying to flee Ukraine under these circumstances. What do you know about that?
Yes, so there are some news that people of color have been treated differently. They have not been allowed on trains. It's a little scattered, the news so far. In general, it's often the case then when a group of refugees arrive or leave a place, there are episodes of racism and people who look different from different ethnicity, different culture tend to have a worse treatment than people that look more similar to other Europeans, if it's in Europe.
One of the reasons given sometimes is that people in Ukraine, these are often students who come from Africa, aren't allowed to leave or cross the border because they don't have visas, whereas Ukrainians are able to do it just with ID cards. Does that sound surprising to you?
No, there are a lot of rules on people who are visiting Europe from outside, and there are a lot of limitations on their visa. So certainly people who are from non-EU countries who are visiting will have much more restrictions. And I can see how what will happen with refugees and people who move to neighboring country will be very different if they are national Ukrainians or if they are immigrants, visitors, or people from other non-EU countries. Rules could be very different.
There's plenty of racism in the United States, of course, as we know. Europe is often given better credit than we get for adhering to the UN Convention on Refugees. Is there a big difference between Europe and America when it comes to racism, or is it the same in both places?
Well, so let me distinguish a little bit. So racism is pervasive and a discrimination of people of different colors and races is, I would say, very strong in Europe as in the US. In terms of attitude towards refugees, the United States has a long tradition of admitting hundreds of thousands of refugees, starting from the Vietnamese who came in the 70s, the Cambodian, the Laotian, and then many refugees from the Soviet Union, from African countries. In the last 4 years, in fact, during the Trump administration, the number of refugees admitted in the U.S. decreased significantly, and I would say that in correspondence with the number of refugees being more from the Middle East, of Muslim background, of Arab background, maybe some stronger type of racism and opposition as a reason in the U.S., more than towards refugees in the past. But certainly Europe has not shown, in many cases, a much kinder side with refugees from the Middle East. Although, again, in the more recent wave of Syrians who moved to Europe in the 2015-16, certainly some country like Germany took a much more open and welcoming approach than in the past, and than the United States, in fact.
So obviously immigration policies changed according to a national interest as they change as well. What do you think has been the impact on the neighboring countries of Ukraine to have these refugees streaming over the border?
So as of now, every country is a little scrambling trying to deal with these huge numbers. As you have mentioned, the estimate are 3.5 million people have crossed the border from Ukraine. Only in Poland, 1.5 to 2 million of arrival in a little bit above a month. So right now, the first emergency is to try to find centers to give these people a roof, some food. And certainly this is costly in the short run. And Poland, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, who are the countries that bound on the border, are the one who are paying more the cost. In the medium longer run, very often refugees represent a very valuable asset. They will start working, they will integrate, and there are many examples in the past of refugees which have been very important in some community to revitalize, to grow. But this is a little bit more in the longer run. Right now, the anxiety of the war, the uncertainty on the war, and the fact that many of these people want to stay relatively close to Ukraine because maybe they want to go back, maybe they have a member of their family who is still in Ukraine, makes the neighbor country carry the cost. And these costs are, of course, high, are emergency in order to accommodate these people. So in the short run, significant economic cost. And we will see in the long run, refugees, though, can be a very important asset for many countries.
If it continues and they move on to France and Germany and other countries nearby, are they going to be accepted there?
So Europe has taken this very, very, very new stand, which is any Ukrainian that arrives in any country of the European Union will be able to work right away, to have the children in school right away, and they will kind of set up immediately this framework to find them a housing, public housing, as they do for refugees. This is definitely new and is part of this sentiment that Europe has, that Ukrainians are the victim of an aggression and they are part of Europe. Of course, it will take a little while. I would say that at the beginning, the biggest resistance will be from Ukrainians who probably will not want to decide that now they are fully resettling. They're still, many of them are women with the children. The husband is still in the country. Elderly people who are kids are still in the country. So in the shorter run, I would say that there will be hesitance for some Ukrainian. But For those who will want to go to the UK, to France, to Italy, these countries, I would say, will very soon, much sooner than it has happened with many other refugees wave, try to connect them with jobs, connect them with school. And this is huge in a sense. This is very important. Some of the job that they can be offered are jobs that some of these countries need, assistance to elderly people, assistance to children. So there could be a very positive economic dynamics if some of these Ukrainian find their way into some of the European countries. For now, we see a lot of them still a little bit waiting in the neighbor countries.
Will there be the same kind of racial discrimination, though, in those broader, more distant countries?
I would say that one regularity that we see in the past is that refugees from Europe are met with less discrimination than from outside Europe. I guess the closest example are the Bosnian refugees in the 90s that fled the war in the ex-Yugoslavia. And those have been in many European countries among the best integrated refugees in terms of finding a job, kind of having their kids in school. So this proximity, in a sense, although Ukrainians are not just like the Italian and the French, but there is a stronger cultural proximity than, for instance, relative to the Syrian who arrived in the 2015. They are Christian, they are in Europe. I think this will help for sure. Of course, there is evidence that if a very large wave arrives in a very short time, this can create some of a backlash. And so how distributed they are, how Europe is able to distribute and kind of dilute a little bit in time will help the acceptance of some of these refugees.
You make a distinction between refugees that are fleeing from war, such as we're seeing now, and economic migrants. Tell us more about that distinction.
Yes, so these are two very different group of people. So economic migrant, first of all, I want to clarify, most of the migration in the recent decades into Europe and into the United States have been economic migrant, meaning migrant who leave their country with a plan, either because they want to work or study or open a business or join a family member in another country. They are moving, you know, at slower rate, but they constitute 90% of the immigrants in the U.S. Or in Europe. They normally tend to have relatively good skills. They look for jobs. They have been an incredible contributor in the U.S. Many of them are scientists, engineers. They have contributed to the growth of those areas. And if they are laborer workers, they tend to go in jobs where there is a high demand. Sometimes there are shortages. They work assisting the elderly, they work in restaurant, in hospitality. These are the economic migrant, which are the large majority in which the move is more planned and more diluted over time. The refugees are people who flee a war or an extreme danger type of situation. They tend to arrive much more, all at the same time. And sometimes they have not chosen to migrate, certainly not to the same extent than the refugees. So maybe their skill, their language, their knowledge of the language of the country where they go is less. And for them, over the evidence is that it's harder. They also come from trauma in the short run. They also come from extreme situations. So the integration in jobs, in labor markets has been a little significantly harder for this group. Again, I will distinguish between Europe and the U.S. The U.S. has in the past received very selected quote-unquote migrants because refugees, because the refugee who arrive the U.S. in the U.S. are first vetted by the United Nations, and then they come in the resettlement program. And so they have received refugees which are a little bit more selected in a sense, and they have integrated better in the American society. Europe, sometimes receiving just people just fleeing North Africa, Middle East, have received a more broader and different variety of refugees, and they have had a little harder time, especially, as I said, the Syrians, the Afghani, the Iraqi that were fleeing those wars to integrate in the US. But taken as a whole, immigrants and refugees have been a very important asset in the economy of the receiving country. Immigrants right away productive. Refugees, after a period of investment in their education, culture, and in the longer run, they have all contributed to the growth, the expansion, and the success of the economic of the economy of the United States in very important part.
Back to the racial discrimination that's been reported quite widely in other parts of the world, but not very much in the American press. Is it possible that Poland and others that are guilty of that kind of discrimination, are they violating the UN Convention on Refugees?
Well, if certainly they discriminate across refugees based on anything, based on a racial basis, they certainly will be violating. In fact, race is one of the reasons to petition for asylum, to request the status of refugees. If you are persecuted because of race, many people move to country in order to be to request asylum for that. So clearly, separating, discriminating along the lines of race is wrong. But as I said, and as you hinted, it's truly different. And here, even adhering to the convention, you have different criteria. If people who are moving are nationals into Poland, are nationals of other countries which are not Ukraine, and so they have the option of going back to their own country, in a sense, when fleeing Ukraine, then a third country like Poland could legitimately ask these people not to be, who are not Ukrainian national, not to request asylum, but to repatriate in their country where they are national of.
And just quickly, to put all this in context, when did the Convention on Refugees get established, and what, generally speaking, does it require?
So the Convention on Refugees got established after World War II. And so they had in mind that it was patterned in large part to try to avoid a drama and a tragedy like the one of the Jews in Europe who were trying to flee Germany or the neighbor country and had a very hard time coming to the US or other places. So it is a pattern around some kind of reason for persecution, which are very specific, which are race, ethnicity, religion. And then it has been extended to conflicts, to wars, to admit some of the people fleeing war. But again, the application has been quite varied because this this time with this war in Ukraine is probably the first time that in Europe there has been such a massive acceptance of the fact that a lot of these people will be refugees in Europe. As I said, with other type of refugees and war, the process to become a refugee, request asylum and become a refugee status, it's very long. It could be very cumbersome, even if you come from a country. You have to prove persecution. You have to prove kind of that you have been persecuted.
Very quickly, just back to the racial question. Are you surprised that the U.S. media has not made more of this issue of discrimination, given the concern that we've had for the past few years, really, with regard to Black Lives Matter and the emphasis in this country by the media on racial issues?
So maybe, I don't know, I guess in the big picture, probably these episodes of discrimination are not and should not be what characterizes the reaction of Europeans to this large flow of refugees. I think correctly that the U.S. right now is going for unity with Europe, showing the same type of attitude, which is more trying to show support for Ukraine, support. They pledged, President Biden pledged that 100,000 refugees will be admitted in the U.S., Ukrainian. So I think that the emphasis right now would be to show kind of same aim and same attitude with Europe, and so criticizing them for some of these episodes, which I think are not so prominent, may have been against this type of spirit that they are trying to do. So that's maybe why, in spite of the fact that in general, racism towards immigrants is a big issue, is a big problem, and and we should definitely address it.
Okay, and of course it always looks differently to different people depending on what their points of view might be. Giovanni Perry, the director of the Global Migration Center at UC Davis, it's been great to have you with us, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The producer of To The Point is Andrea Brody, with assistance from Tyler Boudreau and Anna Buss. Our engineer's John Meek. Now it's your turn. If you like To The Point podcast and you want to hear more, leave a review. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or my Twitter handle is WarrenOnly1. Thanks for being with us this time, and join us again.